Episode 3, The Beatles' Second Album.
The Beatles come to America. Yeah, 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 yeah.
Welcome to the Beatles Come to America podcast. I am your host, Tom Gallagher, along with the Beatle guru, Brooke Halpin. Today, we're talking about the Beatles' second album. A lot of Motown covers, a lot of roots rock and roll covers, and a lot of fun. This is the third album released in 1964, and it's only April. April 10th, to be exact. Tape your pennies to the needlearm. It is time to get deep into the grooves. Before we get into the conversation, we got some housekeeping notes that we want to share with you. I have a podcast. It's called Something Came from Baltimore, which is a music interview podcast, more on jazz and R&B and blues. It's not really about Baltimore, but please subscribe, and the links are in the show notes. The Beatle guru, Brooke Halpin, is all-knowing when it comes to the Beatles. He sweats Beatle DNA, and you need to follow him on his Facebook page called Come Together with the Beatles and Brooke Halpin. That link is also in the show notes. And then we have our own Facebook page here for the Beatles Coming to America. And what we're asking you to do is subscribe and then also rank your favorite Beatle U.S. albums, the best, the worst, and then listen to our podcast. And what I think you're going to find is that you're going to have a tough time, and it's possible that you may change your rankings. Also, we are a DIY low-tech production, so we're both in our living rooms. It's The Beatles Come to America, Episode 3, The Beatles' Second Album. Tonight on the phone, we have the one and only The Beatle Guru, Brooke Halpin, and we are up to the second album.
Thank you, Tom. It's always a pleasure and a lot of fun to be with you.
Yes, it is. And I'm so excited to have you. I'm excited because I did research on this album and I thought, oh, I can't wait to talk to Brooke about this album. It's the second album. And what's crazy about it is just a timeline. I believe we're in total Beatlemania right now. So January 10th, the intro comes out. Meet the Beatles come out 10 days later, January 20th. Right. Now we're looking at April 10th and we have the second album. So we have three amazing albums that just came out within a short period of time. This one, they culled from 25 songs that were just kind of already recorded and ready to go. So I think they did a really good job with it. I just took a little note. The All Music Guide says that this stands to probably be the best pure rock and roll album ever issued by the group. It avoids all the traces of pop ballads favored by Paul McCartney that usually slows down the group's other earlier albums. And the result was the longest uninterrupted body of hard rock and roll and R&B in their whole entire output.
I have to agree with that. I really do. This is the Beatles' rock and roll and rhythm and blues album. As you said, there's no ballads on the album. 11 songs. And out of the 11, which is interesting, is that there's only 5 original songs, and there are 6 covers. But what we should mention from the get-go is that the title, as you said, The Beatles, it's The Beatles' Second Album. Well, ladies and gentlemen, it's not The Beatles' Second Album. It's actually The Beatles' Third Album, because this is the second album on Capitol Records, but it's not the second album that was released in the U.S., because we know the first one was introducing the Beatles on DJ. And you mentioned the release date, for instance, on introducing the Beatles was January 10th, and this is coming out on another 10th, April 10th. I'm surprised that John didn't say, knowing John, say, now I want it released on the 9th. You know, this is John. John, of course, is the number 9 is his favorite number, but that's a little bit of a aside. But anyhow, you agree with me that this is not really the second album, right?
I love this album. If I would rank the three albums that we've talked about, this would be my number 1. The intro would be 2, and Meet the Beatles would be 3. And the reason I like this the best is that all these songs really stand the test of time. There's not one song that I was like, I don't remember that song. It's exciting to go through an album like that. It's short. It's only 27 minutes,
but it's a really great collection of songs.
It completely rocks. Now, the other thing I should mention before we get into each individual track is that, for God's sake, I wish someone at Capitol Records had more of an imagination, some creativity, to give it a better title for the Beatles' second album. I mean, come on, that's a terrible name for an album, I think. Especially given, as you said, you know, the mania that was going on with the Beatles. Now, of course, they could have named it, you know, the Beatles whatever, and it would have sold anyway. But it just, it's not a very good title for an album. I don't think so. It's a terrible name, the Beatles' second album. You know, they could have said the Beatles' rock and roll rhythm and blues album, or the, you know, something like that, or something different than just the second album. Now, I should mention also on the cover, which I absolutely love, it does say, and I have to agree with this, that electrifying big beat performances, and they are very much electrifying, by England, Paul McCartney, John Lennon, George Harrison, and Ringo Starr. So that's very, very true. And then on the back cover, it says, which is really kind of, I think, not kind of, but also very true at the time, never before has show business seen and heard anything like them here. And here they are, the world's most popular force in singing and playing their new collection of hits. Okay, very good. You know, that's also very good. And the photograph. I remember getting this album in the mail. My aunt's California mailed it to me when I was living in Connecticut when I was a young lad. And I remember opening this thing up, and I saw the photographs on the cover. Because some of them are live. You know, they're live shots of John strumming his Rickenbacker and Paul and George singing into the same microphone, and some photographs from the Beatles performing on the Ed Sullivan Show. And also, there's one photograph on the back of them at the Washington, D.C. Coliseum, February 1964. So that was really good, you know, that they made that match to put together at least the appropriate photographs to parallel the fact that the songs on the album are indeed electrifying.
Yeah, they are. And I like the fact that you had 25 songs that you could pick and choose. What they picked out, I think, is just a solid album. More than a solid album. There's not a dud in this whole thing. There's nothing but praise on this album. Other than that, sure, it's exciting. You can feel the excitement on this album. You were alive that time period. And was mania, like, peaking or starting to peak?
Oh, it was full throttle. In April of 64, it was, that's all we ever heard on the radio. That's all we ever wanted. It's complete, total Beatles. And the radio stations, and I'll never forget this, of course, they get advanced copies of this. They got advanced copies of this album like they do with all the singles and all of the albums for promotional purposes. And I remember listening to this radio station in Hartford, Connecticut, and they would be playing, like, for instance, what was the track there? You Really Got a Hold on Me, right? And then Big D exclusively, you know, he would actually record that or say it. I think it was a recording over the actual song, which made it even more exciting because no one had the ability to purchase the album. So we were hearing the songs from this album on the radio before it was actually available in stores. So to hear these songs on the radio in April, early April, 1964, it was like the most exciting thing that one could experience. And when I listened to this album, every single song on this album blew me away. And when it comes to the Beatles and a rock and roll R&B album, this is number one. That's all.
All right. So we're at our first song, which is Roll Over Beethoven. It was recorded on July 30th in 1963. It was only recorded in 5 takes. This is obviously a Chuck Berry song, and I don't know this to be true, but just on research is just saying they covered more Chuck Berry songs than anyone else.
Well, I'm gonna write a little letter. I'm gonna mail it to my local DJ. Yeah, it's a jumping little record I want my jockey to play. Beethoven, I gotta hear it again today.
Yeah, well, that's true. And what's interesting is that they're giving George Harrison singing the lead track on an album. track one, side one. That's pretty amazing for George to be singing the lead vocal on the first track on an album, because back then, that didn't happen. He did have the opening track on side two of Meet the Beatles, you know, which was Don't Bother Me, but not on side one. And then he had the opening track on side two of Pepper. But he did, the only other time he had an opening track on an album other than this one, the Beatles' second album, was Revolver. They gave George the opening track on Revolver. So straight away, now, you know, we're hearing George Harrison, his vocals on Roll Over Beethoven. I mean, not only does he, his vocals are superb, but his guitar playing is just perfect. And I could remember playing this album over and over and over again. Whenever I was home from school, the first thing I would do is I would play this album. And then when I finally got a band put together, one of the first things that we learned and that we played was Roll Over Beethoven. And as you said earlier, the energy in all of these tracks, but I think particularly, actually, there's an energy in Roll Over Beethoven, which is over the top. It's just completely irresistible. And it's just as exciting today as it was in 1964.
That's exactly what I was thinking about. You know, the Chuck Berry song was recorded in 1956, and that feels dated for some reason. But the Beatles version never sounds dated. There's something great about it. And then there's that weird thing where Electric Light Orchestra did a cover of it because of Jeff Lynne, and then those two became buddies. And it's a weird, small music world. But Roll Over Beethoven to me is a fantastic song. I think as a rock song, it's one of their best of all time.
Absolutely. And that's probably the reason why they picked it as the opening track, is my guess.
Our second song is Thank You Girl.
Yeah, Thank You Girl is interesting because it was a B-side. It was a B-side twice, actually. The first time it was the B-side on the VJ release back in May of 63 to the A-side From Me to You. And it was released in the States. And it tanked because the Beatles were not selling in 63, believe it or not. And there was no money. VJ didn't have any money to promote the record. But then it came out again in March of 64, a little less than a year later. And it was the B-side to Do You Want to Know a Secret? And because Beatlemania had taken off, then it rode the coattails, if you will, of the single Do You Want to Know a Secret? And I think it's a very good song. The lyrics are fantastic because they're basically thanking the fans. You know, when the girls heard this song, you know, back in 64, when they heard the word you, and the Beatles were very clever about this with their lyrics, because this is the first original song on the album. The girls believed in their imagination and in their fantasy, they believed that the Beatles were thanking them. That was part of it. Whether they were conscious of it or not, that's what they thought, that's what they felt. And this song clearly does that. And All I Want to Do is Thank You Girl. Thank You Girl. My God, what a fantastic lyric for the time. It was perfect. Yeah, well, I just wanted to mention before we get further into You Really Got a Hold on Me, one of the things that I love about Thank You Girl was at the ending of the song, all they're doing vocally, Tom's going, ow, 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 you, ow, ow. And then there was these incredible drum fills. I mean, listen to the drumming at the end of the song. Oh, 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 da, 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 da. You know, it's an amazing ending for the single. So I thought it's important to mention that. I think it was a very unusual ending, actually. But then again, it added to the excitement of the song and what was going on at that time while the Beatles were taking off worldwide with the Beatlemania. It's really unusual, the O-O. And, of course, the O-O's are completely bathed in reverb, which was an exciting effect that was used, you know, back in 64. So I just wanted to mention that.
I thought it was an A-side for some reason because it holds up really well. I know that it was on two B-sides, but it was played enough that I think that it feels like an A-side.
It feels like an A-side.
Yeah, it feels like an A-side. Because I was like, wait a minute, that's a B-side twice? I know. We're going to talk about Swan. There's other labels that come into our world. But, you know, singles were coming out left and right at this point. And now that one is fantastic. I believe this one is a great, we're on track number three, is with John as lead on You Really Got a Hold on Me. It's a copy of the Smokey Robinson and the Miracles.
Yeah.
1962.
Yeah.
It went top 10 for them. John and Jordan's on lead and Paul's doing harmony. And George Martin's doing the piano. A lot of covers, like the Supremes, the Temps, they all did it. But I believe John Lennon's version is amazing.
As you said, it was written by Smokey Robinson and recorded by him in the Miracles. And John Lennon's lead vocal he's like this sexy crooner in this song. I don't want you, but I need you. I don't want to kiss you. I mean, it's like, oh my God, it's so irresistible. How could you not fall in love with his vocals on this song? Oh, 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 you do me badly. So, yeah, this song, I think it might be, and it's not the best, it's certainly one of the best covers that they ever did in their entire recorded history. The sound of George's guitar and the low strings is perfect. Ringo's drumming is perfect. Paul and George are perfect in the background. It's a perfect cover. Absolutely perfect cover. And it's one of my favorite songs, and I still play quite a bit on my radio show to this very day because it's so damn good.
Brian Holland was just on Rolling Stone, the podcast. And he basically said that if it wasn't for the Beatles, the Motown label wouldn't be flush with cash that they were able to work because that was an independent label. And the fact that they did these covers, and there's three on this album, it drew more attention to Motown and gave it total legitimate like cachet. Like it's not a corny label. This is something that's important. The Beatles like it, you know, that's their stamp of approval. And with the song, some people have may not have heard that because it may not have crossed over. So they were able to really bring attention to that label. And in other words, if it wasn't for the Beatles, the Motown sound or the Motown in general probably would not have existed.
Well, especially during the British invasion, because when the British invasion was launched, and of course the Beatles were the ones who launched it, then all the other genres took a huge backseat. You know, the top 10 in February, March of 1964, especially March, it was the British invasion. The Beatles had like the first five slots on the Billboard in March, I believe it was. So Motown was like, what's Motown? No, we have to keep playing, you know, the Beatles and the Rolling Stones. And what's the other band that just came across the water? Oh, yeah, Jerry the Pacemaker. Let's get them up on the charts. So, yeah. So what, as you're saying, it was like the Beatles brought in, into the mania, they brought the Motown songs, which were not getting any airplay at the time, they brought them forward and into their recordings on the albums. And it was a huge boost for not only for Motown, but also, you know, they were getting, the writers were getting writers' royalties, and the publishers of those songs were getting huge, huge publishing royalties because of the number of sales of the album. You know, this album was certified gold, I think, like in 2 weeks or something. So it was an economic boost to the music publishers who own the publishing rights to these Motown songs, and a boost to the recording artist as well.
Yeah, you never think of how the Beatles helped Motown. The next song, we got Devil in Her Heart. It's a Richard Drapin song. I don't know who Richard Drapin is. It's a George lead.
I love it. I like the music is kind of, it's got a different rhythm and a different feel to it, you know, compared to Roll Over Beethoven and Thank You Girl. It had a different kind of, wouldn't you agree, there's some kind of the percussion is quite nice. You know, Ringo's playing not only the drums, of course, but he's got the maracas, you know, and that, I think that the maracas, it gave it a different kind of feel.
Like a little bossa nova vibe to it.
Yeah. And the harmonies, oh my God. You know, the vocals, the Beatles vocals back then, they were so tight. And some people consider them to be a vocal band. A vocal group, excuse me, you know, a pop vocal group, which they were, you know, their vocals were incredible together. And I just think that this is another good example of how well John, Paul, George, and sang together back then.
I agree. I love it. That's a great song. And to maybe the reason we might not know Devil in Her Heart is the same reason why they picked Money as a song. It was never a hit in the UK. And what I'm hearing or doing my research is that Brian Epstein's record store had a lot of these imports, and this import of Money came out. I believe maybe Devil in Her Heart. They're getting some really rare stuff that they're honing in the Tavern Club that seem like they're their songs because no one else knows them. So Money is, to me, is amazing, a great song. And it was the first hit that Berry Gordy had in the Motown for Tambla Records.
And right, and it was a hit. It did chart well.
Yeah, it did not, it did do nothing over in UK. And,
right, up in the UK, right.
And I think this is a fantastic song. What's your thoughts on it?
Give me money. All those mean dreams, what I want.
Well, again, you have to listen to John's vocal. I mean, how in the world can anyone listening to this song, if you listen to it today and you hear John singing, it's completely captivating. It completely takes you in. It's sultry. It's sexy. It's gritty. It's guttural. It's a rockin', screaming vocal that John delivers on this song. I think I like, as much as his vocal is great on Twist and Shout, I prefer his lead vocal on Money. And the funny thing is that, it's really quite funny, is that he's singing, that's all he wants is money, right? The best thing in life is free, blah, 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 blah. Well, John, you got it, baby. You know, he certainly got the money, that's all I want, you know, and that's certainly what he and the rest of the Beatles got. Well, deservedly, of course, but it was interesting that he would be screaming those vocals at a time when, for the first time in his life and the other Beatles' lives, that the money was coming in hand over fist. So it's very appropriate that he would be singing and the Beatles would be singing this song at this time when they were getting all the money. And, so, you know, obviously they wanted more than money. But you get my point.
Sure.
I wanted to mention, again, on Money, That's All I Want, listening to it today and, of course, for the first time back in April 64, the riff, it was doubled, right? It's on the guitars, but George Martin, he doubled it on the piano twice. He overdubbed that riff on the piano, and the way they mixed it in, it was just like, oh my God, listen to this sound. So they were, not only were they doing a spectacular cover of the song, but the way that they did the arrangement and the way that they did the recording, and with George, with Master George at the controls as the producer, hold on, boys, I think I'll lay down the piano track here, you know, kind of thing. It's just, that was part of the chemistry, and I'd go so far as to say is the magical combination. Because, you know, there's dozens of people who recorded Money. I mean, it's, you know, a very popular song, but none of them sound like this. And part of the reason is because of George Martin and because of him doing that double track piano.
Smokey did a great version of this, but I feel this is a completely different song just by the energy level and the, it's like it's an R&B rock song combined together with John's vocals. It's a strong, strong song. And they ranked it the 24th best Beatles song of all time. I kind of agree that it's pretty up there. It's the energy level for this whole album. There's no dip. And it's,
yep.
So you just keep on going. And then the last song on this side is You Can't Do That, which I love too. I think it's awesome. The You Can't Do That is the B-side of Can't Buy Me Love. It's a John song. There's notation that this is a theme of him being the jealous guy and moody. Yeah, Run for Your Life, Jealous Guy.
Right.
You Can't Do That. He said it was influenced by someone that wasn't famous at the time, which is Wilson Pickett. This was listed as a song that they were going to play on a Hard Day's Night where the concert footage was, but they yanked it at the last minute because of the...
Yeah, the director did. Yeah, Richard Lester did. Yeah.
But I love this song. I think it's great. And I have just the sheer love of it. I never thought of analyzing it to a point of, you know, John's psyche or whatever. I was like, You Can't Do That. It's just a great song to me. I don't combine it in his, you know, his work and say, oh, this is a theme that's running through his work. I just love this song.
something to say that might cause you pain. If I catch you talking to that boy again, I'm gonna let you down and leave you flat. Because I told you before, oh, you can't do that. Well, it's the second time I caught you talking to him.
Yeah, well, now, as you had said, you know, for John to say, I'm telling you, you can't do that, is extremely possessive. It's a command. It's a demand. He's demanding this, which is really, at that time in 64, it's like, but no one stopped to think, oh my God, what is he talking about? Because the song sounded so good. And back then, I don't think that people had the desire even to deep in, to say, to analyze, as you were saying, to analyze the lyrics. It's like, I told you before that you can't do that. If I catch you talking to that boy again, you know, I'm going to let you down. I mean, it's so possessive. And at the time when all the Beatlemania was going on and everybody was falling in love with each other, it was just seemed to be rather contrary to the social side, the things that was going on in society at the time, you know, the social background. People were not saying, hey, wait a minute, you know, you can't, I don't want to hear about you being possessive and you being jealous and all that. But aside from that, it's one of the best songs that John wrote, and it's one of the most unusual songs for John, because he's playing the lead guitar solo in this song, and most people don't know that. Everybody, especially back in 64, no one, because when they saw the Beatles on the Ed Sullivan Show, or they saw tapes of the Beatles or videos of them or whatever it was, George Harrison always played the lead guitar solo in the songs. They did perform this during some of, I think, their 64 parts, during their 64 tours, that this was included in their repertoire. But if you see any footage of it, John made a point that he would not be seen playing lead guitar in this song. It's remarkable because it's a very, very good lead guitar solo. But I think he felt somewhat insecure about his lead guitar playing. So he didn't want to be seen playing it. And also, here we are raving about his incredible vocals on the Beatles' second album. And John never liked the sound of his singing voice, which is mind-blowing. Because the rest of the world were drooling over every time they heard him sing. It was like, oh my God, this guy is the best singer I've ever heard. So it's really fascinating, looking back at it now, that John plays the lead guitar solo, and he didn't want to admit it. And don't you think it's a great lead guitar solo?
It is. Just by doing the research, I went, wow, maybe there is some kind of theme thing going on here. But when it comes to like John Lennon's vocals, when he went solo, he was alone without Yoko, it was, you know, he was very concerned about his vocals, and he would put a lot of layers it was like he was singing off of a mountain. It's amazing because this is like the perfect like roughness and sensitivity attached to it. And I think this is another, you know, A side to me. It was a cover by
Harry Nelson,
Supremes, and Vanilla Fudge.
I got something to say that might cause you pain.
I think it's a great closer for side one, and it just gets great just on side two when we have Long Tall Sally with Paul doing the vocals on this one. It's a Little Richard song. It was made on March 1st, 1964, and they pumped it out pretty fast if you think about it, because the album came out in April. George Martin is playing the piano, and it's the last song that they ever played live to a paying audience. It was in Candlestick Park on August 29th, 1966. And I read that they asked, they wanted documentation of this last concert, and they put a tape on, and the second chorus got cut off. And it was just a mistake. They just ran out of tape. I don't know who only puts out a 30-minute tape to tape the Beatles, but obviously they went over 30 minutes and the song was cut in half. There's covers on this. Pat Boone, Elvis, Eddie Cochran, Wanda Jackson, Gene Vincent, and the Kinks. I know we're going to say nice things about this. So, Brooke, what's your thoughts on this song?
Okay, Tom, so let's do a time travel. We're going to go back to April 1964. You and I, we just got out of school, you know, out of junior high school. And I told you that I just got this album in the mail from my aunt, California. And you didn't have it. So, and I'm sorry that you didn't. But anyhow, we go back to my house. And I'm playing it for you. We had just listened to Roll Over Beethoven, Thank You Girl, You Really Got a Hold on Me, Devil in Her Heart, Money, and You Can't Do That. And we're completely blown away from all of that incredible energy, musicianship, and great vocals. And then we turn the album over, and I put the arm down on the track one on side two. And then we hear Long Tall Sally. It was like, are you kidding me? It was so overwhelming. I'm not exaggerating. At the time, after having all those incredible performances and recordings on side one, and then now we have Paul singing his heart out, singing Long Tall Sally. It was so overwhelming and way beyond exciting. It really was.
Do you like this version better than the Little Richard version?
Yeah, I do. I do. And again, Mr. George Martin, you know, he's there playing the piano again. Yeah, so he was there, not only as a producer, but he was the fifth Beatle. At this time in the Beatles' career, absolutely. He was the fifth Beatle, no doubt about it. And you were mentioning that Long Tall Sally was the song, the last song that they played at Candlestick Park in August 1966. They used to close with this song for most of their shows. They didn't do it in 65. In 65, they closed the show with I'm Down for a lot of their concerts. But predominantly, they closed their shows with Long Tall Sally. Paul had said to, I forget, it was the press secretary at the time who was traveling with the Beatles on the tour in 66, U.S. tour. And like last minute, he goes, why don't you record this? You know, here's a tape recorder and a tape or something, you know, something like that. And yes, it was a 30-minute cassette tape, you know, and it was a small little cassette tape recorder, Tom. You know, so there was very, very poor audio quality. And I have that recording. I don't know how I got it. I don't know if someone emailed it to me or sent it to me. I have that. And I did my best to clean up the entire tape recording because historically it's huge from a Beatles historical perspective, that this is the last performance that the Beatles did, not including, you know, what they did on the rooftop, which is, there's no comparison. The rooftop performance was put together quickly, and there were only a handful of people up on the roof. I mean, this was their last staged public concert that they did. And you're right. I'm listening to Long Tall Sally, and then it ends abruptly because the tape ran out. But, yeah, McCartney as a vocalist, you know, you've got John who sings one way. John does not sing like Paul. Paul does not sing like John. George does not sing like Paul or John. But somehow, when the three of them, who especially John and Paul as vocalists, were so their vocals are so commanding and so attractive and appealing, then when the three of them sang together, somehow the three different voices blended together perfectly. But McCartney was the one who was the screamer. He was the one who was able to hit those really super high notes that John did not hit, that he could not hit. John could do some high falsettos, but Paul did the really high screeching notes, full voice. He does it in Long Tall Sally, and he did it very similarly when he sang I'm Down, which is a song that they also closed their concerts with. At Shea Stadium was the song that they closed that concert with. So, yeah, there's nothing, no one even comes close, I believe, to Paul McCartney and the Beatles' version of Long Tall Sally.
I'm going to tell it, Mary, about Uncle John. He said he had the busy, but he got a lot of fun.
I think that a lot of people wondered why they were playing these songs when they had some newer songs out. And it's just because this song kicks ass. That's all. It's a great song.
It's a perfect show closer. Even 2 years later, in August 66, they're still closing out their shows with this song.
Yeah.
That's how powerful.
The next song is I Call Your Name. John wrote this song and didn't really like it, so he gave it to Billy J. Kramer. And
right.
The Dakotas, and it was the B-side of Bad to Me, and Lennon
right.
really didn't like their version at all. So he went right. back and said, I'll record it, make it better.
I call your name, but you're not there.
George Harrison used the Rickenbacker guitar, created a new sound. The first time that they tried to do ska, don't you know I can't take it?
Don't you know I can't take it? I don't know who can. I'm not gonna make it. I'm not that kind of man.
The guitar riffs on this song are. Yeah, I mean, come on. Who was doing that back then?
No one.
It's no one. No one. And again, you know, they kept evolving. It wasn't like, well, you know, we had a great big hit with Please Please Me, and then, oh, gee, we had another hit with She Loves You, and oh, now we have another hit with I Want to Hold Your Hand. If you look just at those three songs in terms of songwriting, Tom, there's an evolution in terms of the way they were writing songs. Now, granted, John wrote even back then, in the early, way back then at 64, 63 even. They weren't writing them together, but they were evolving as songwriters. So when you get to I Call Your Name, and like we're talking about, the guitar work in I Call Your Name is just phenomenal. Absolutely pulls you in. It's just so addictive. It's a fantastic song. And John, again, John's vocal, I don't know anyone who could sing the song better than John. Now, I know that the Mamas and the Papas did a cover version of it, but, you know, they were smart because they knew to listen. If we're going to do a cover version of this song, then we have to do a rearrangement of it. You know, we have to do a different version of the song, which they did. You know, they slowed it down.
I call your name, but you're not there.
And, of course, that was also a hit. Yeah, it was quite a pretty big hit for the Mamas and the Papas in 66, because that when that came out. But getting back to the Beatles' version of the song, it's one of John's best, as certainly at that time, during the time period. Absolutely a fantastic song. Oh, by the way, and they changed the rhythmic feel in the song, in the instrumental part. You know, during the verse, and it's dun 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 dun. But then during the instrumental, he's strumming instead of doing, you know, downbeats. John is strumming upbeats on the offbeat. So it's like, which changes the whole feel of that instrumental section. Nobody was doing stuff like that in 1964. Another example of their brilliance.
We're up to Please, Mr. Postman, which is, you know, yeah. Okay, here we go again. The Marvelettes added a hit in 61.
Yeah. Oh, yes, wait a minute, Mr. Postman.
It only hit number 30 in Billboard. Can we talk about how perfect this song is also?
Yeah, well, again, this is how John, another great example of John's vocal style in 1963-64. He was, I would say, that he was in top form. I think that his vocals during this time period were his best. Now, there's nothing wrong with him singing Help, but there's something about, I think it had to do with the fact that they were so confident now. There's a certain confidence, that's what it is, in his voice. When he's singing these songs, and it comes through on these tracks. And the way the song is produced, they're using a lot of reverb on the vocals, and the vocals are phenomenal. By the way, John's vocal is actually double-trapped to add even more excitement to the vocals. And the background vocals with Paul and George are perfect. And again, you have to put this, as we are, in the context of what preceded it, right? We just heard I Call Your Name, and before that we just heard Long Tall Sally. So it's like our minds are getting blown by one song, and then the next song blows our mind again, and then the next song continues to blow our mind. You see what I'm saying? So when you look at this album in its entirety, I don't think, as we said at the outset of this show, that there is no Beatles album that does that continuously from track to track to track to track in terms of the high energy, the excitement, and the vocal performances all in one album.
Wait a minute, oh yeah. Check it and see one more time for me. You gotta wait a minute, oh yeah.
Our fourth track on side two is I'll Get You. Okay, so it's a B-side to She Loves You on Swan label.
Well, again, you see, they're really working that short little word, you, right? We talked about the way they talked about, thank you, girl. She loves you, right? I want you to hold my hand. So they're doing the same thing during this period where they're using the word you, and it's going right to the hearts of the girls at the time. And I know it, and I saw it. It was so effective. Because the Beatles were telling these girls, and actually the guys as well, that they're going to get them. I'll get you. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. So it's a great song. It's a B-side, as you said. But the thing that I love about it is that, you know, we've got John on harmonica on this song. And he was playing a lot of harmonica back in 63 and 64. Love Me Do, obviously, you know, is loaded with harmonica and many other songs from that time period. So, yeah, I'll get you in the end. Oh, yeah, oh, yeah. And they did. That's the point. The point is that they did. They got everybody. By this time, I don't know, I can't think of anyone. There may have been a few diehards who resisted the Beatles. I'm talking about teenagers back in April 1964. Yeah, there may have been a few, you know, that were still listening to Chan and Dean and the Beach Boys or something. But boy, they got everybody. They really did. And it's nice that they put this on this album because at this point, you know, they had I'll Get You, and they had She Loves You basically in the vault, if you will. And so they released it on the Beatles' second album.
Oh yeah, oh yeah, oh yeah, oh yeah. Imagine I'm in love with you. It's easy 'cause I know.
Now, which leads us right to the closing track. What a way to close out the album, Tom. Closing out the album with, of all things, She Loves You.
Be glad.
I have so many notes on this song. We'll do the notes, but this deserves a conversation. Best-selling single in the UK in the 60s of all songs.
Yeah.
Rolling Stone ranked it number 64 of the top 500 songs of all time. They used Bobby Rydell's Forget Him, the con response part. They wrote this in a hotel room within 2 hours. Paul has a story about his dad saying yes, yes, yes.
Yeah, right, right.
It was also featured in a CBS Morning News segment in November 22nd, 1963, talking about the Beatles are coming, the Beatles are coming. By December 10th, 1963, Walter Cronkite reran the segment in the evening news, and all of a sudden that built. That was the part where it built the mania up. In 5 weeks at number 2, it was behind I Want to Hold Your Hand, and then it replaced it for 2 weeks after that.
Right.
It's an epic song, and it's fantastic.
But again, you know, here it was released in the U.S., right, September 1963, and it didn't do anything, which, we're talking, people listening to this show that we're doing today, they go, oh, that can't be true. No, but it is true. Because in 63, the Beatles were a flop in the U.S. They were huge in the U.K. They had their first number one single in the U.K. with Please Please Me in 63. But this song did not chart, did not sell. It got very little airplay, if any at all, in the U.S. in 63. And then, because of the success, the huge success of I Want to Hold Your Hand. And once that basically opened the floodgates, I Want to Hold Your Hand. So then it was like, you know, Capitol, who didn't want to do anything with the Beatles in 63, who rejected the Beatles in 1963, and VJ, who had no money to promote the records in 63, now, with the huge success of I Want to Hold Your Hand, they're all going, oh, my God, next, whatever we have, whatever it is, just get it out of the market. And sure enough, at that point, you know, when they released She Loves You as a single, soon after I Want to Hold Your Hand, it went to number one. So they put it on the way to wrap up this album, the Beatles' second album. It's one of the most exciting original songs that the Beatles have ever recorded. And they ended the album, even though there were 6 covers on the album, they ended it with an original, which I'm glad that they did. You know, the last 2 songs being original songs. They put it all together, and to this very day, as I look at the album, I must admit that the album cover is rather tattered, Tom, because it's the original one from April 1960. Yeah, and the other thing that I think is worth mentioning is, in addition to all the things that we were talking about in terms of the incredible energy and performances and vocals and guitar work and production, is that with She Loves You, particularly, it is so positive. Every guy in the world at that time wanted the girl that he was pursuing to love him. And even if you were a young husband, you wanted to make sure that your wife still loved you. So to hear the affirmation, to hear them saying repeatedly, she loves you. Yeah, 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 she does, you know. She loves you. Yeah, 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 yeah. Don't worry about it. She loves you. Yeah. My point is that the message is so positive, which when you add the positive message to everything else that's going on with the great songwriting and vocals and lyrics and production, it's completely irresistible. And that's, I think, you put that all together. But it's, and that's one of the reasons why it's so fantastic and we're so successful. But again, it's the positive energy that the Beatles were exuding at this time with their recordings that was very much part of their success.
And the year end, I Want to Hold Your Hand was number one. Number two was She Loves You. That the top five that we talked about was April 4th, and it was of 1964. It was Camp I'm Your Love, Twist and Shout. Number three was She Loves You, I Want to Hold Your Hand, and Please Please Me. All amazing songs, all bunched together in an amazing way.
That has never happened. That has never happened again.
That's right.
I mean, for the same artist to have the top five positions on the record charts. Come on. That was unheard of before that happened, and it hasn't happened since. It's completely mind-blowing, and it's unprecedented. And they did it. They were the only people who could do it. And that was, again, April 1964. And that's when this album was released.
The second album was 2 million copies, so that's double platinum. Meet the Beatles was three times platinum, I believe. Other one, the intro was 1.5 million. So, you know, in a nutshell, you're looking about like 7 million, you know, just three recordings. That's a lot back then.
Oh, it's a lot now.
Brooke Halperin, the Beatle guru. It's the Beatles Come to America. We are on the second album. We made it through today.
Yes, we did, Tom. It's always a lot of fun and great being with you on your show. Love it.
So what's next for us, Brooke?
Well, next we're going to be diving into the Beatles' A Hard Day's Night album, which is going to be a total blast.
Can't wait for that. All righty. Thank you very much, the Beatle Guru. We'll see you next time.
Thank you, Tom.
Next episode. The Beatles, A Hard Day's Night soundtrack. Now enjoy a Brooke Halperin composition called Strange Lullabies.
I hear strange lullabies, blowing dust into my eyes. Everywhere I look, I see signs. Do not enter, not this time. Leaving me paralyzed from the darkness, voices rise. I hear strange, strange lullabies. I hear strange, strange, strange lullabies. Signs. Do not enter, no, not this time.
End of episode.